You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Long before we learned about PFAS chemicals contaminating groundwater at 67 sites in 34 counties, Michiganders were faced with a pollution disaster that is still being felt today. It happened in 1973. Workers at a chemical plant in St. Louis, Michigan, accidentally mixed a toxic flame retardant chemical called polybrominated biphenyl, or PBB, into animal feed. The end results? Millions of Michiganders wound up with PBB in their bodies. Bridge Magazine reporters Jim Malowitz and Riley Began are out now with a series of stories on the two big chemical contaminations several decades apart. Jim, tell us, what did you want to explore with all these stories?
Well, really what we're looking at is, I think both Riley and I were younger Michiganders, and we weren't around when the PBB mix-up happened. And as we started looking into just the workings of state government, and when we joined Bridge a couple years ago, and learning about how huge this PBB crisis was back in the 70s, it was kind of all new to us. And we both kind of together, as we were looking forward to some of the issues that Michigan is dealing with now with chemical contamination, a different type of chemical, PFAS, we kind of realized that we were reading and reporting on some of the same things that we were kind of looking back at when we were learning about PBB. So we kind of just wanted to look at, you know, what lessons should Michigan have learned during the crisis, and what lessons did Michigan learn, and what were these parallels that we're seeing again.
Riley, briefly walk us through and remind us what happened with that PBB crisis, because it really truly was an environmental and agricultural crisis, wasn't it?
Yeah, so essentially what happened is there was this company in St. Louis, Michigan, small town in the middle of the mitten, and they were producing a cattle feed that was called NutriMaster. They were also producing a fire retardant. What is it called? Flame Master?
Yes.
Yep. And understandably, those bags eventually got mixed up. They got shipped out to the Farm Bureau, which shipped them out to farms across Michigan, which in turn put meat and milk into the bodies of most Michiganders. So there was this immediate sort of chaos right after that happened, where people didn't know what was happening with their cattle or what was really happening with their bodies. But then a part of what our project looks into is not only what happened immediately after the PBB crisis, but sort of what legacy that company left in St. Louis, where they were the major employer for decades and were producing other things like DDT.
And as you show us in your stories, that old plant site is now an EPA Superfund cleanup site. We have actually talked about that here on Stateside. And you stop and you go, wait a minute, it's still being cleaned up 46 years later, right now in 2019. And it's a group of citizens that really are keeping a real close eye on that, isn't it?
Right. It's the Superfund task force, the Pine River task force, that's been meeting once a month, every month, for the past 21 years, even though it's been, you know, more than four decades since the PBB mix-up happened. There was a lag time in between when the EPA came in to decide, yes, this is a Superfund site and we're going to clean it up, because originally the state and federal government had told residents that site was safe. And it turns out that that pollution leached into the Pine River that hugged the factory. So this group of citizens has been meeting every month, led by a core group that's still there and still just really cares about their community. And they're basically watchdogging the state and federal effort to clean it up. And they've had a lot of kind of trials and triumphs along the way, but still this stuff isn't cleaned up.
And this is I think we're going to be hearing some themes as we talk here, because you do make it very clear, Riley Began and Jim Malowitz, in your stories for Bridge Magazine, that most lessons from that PBB crisis of nearly five decades ago have largely gone unheeded, as state and federal regulators remain ill-equipped, slow to respond to large-scale chemical poisonings, much less prevent one. What lessons should have been picked up? What lessons did come out of what happened with PBB?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that people would definitely argue that some things have changed since 1973, right? The way that we treat chemical contaminants is a little bit different. But sort of the fundamental problem that, you know, citizens, activists, politicians, scientists, everyone told us, that government really didn't learn this concept of making sure that we vet our chemicals before they go into, you know, use. Right now, the way that the system works is essentially we create chemicals, we use them until we figure out that they are bad for us. And, you know, there are a lot of complicated arguments on both sides about why that is the way that it is. But I think people who are living through these contamination crises look at it and they're like, why is that our system?
Yeah. What else? What other lessons came out of PBB?
I mean, it's that and just, I guess, the how streamlined state government is. One thing that a couple of folks who are around for the PBB crisis mentioned to us that did change was that in the early days of the crisis in the 70s, Governor Milliken was not on the same page as his as the Agriculture Department chief, and so there were some things that happened there to that allowed the executive branch of government to move a little bit more swiftly and have more control over some of the state departments.
So Governor Milliken wanted to hit the accelerator pedal, and the agencies were hitting the brakes?
At some point. I mean, I think people would criticize Milliken initially for maybe not understanding and fully grasping the crisis. But at one point, you know, a couple of years in, he wanted to lower the amount of allowable PBB that was in food going to the market, and the state's agriculture department was not on the same page, and it was largely controlled by influences at the Farm Bureau, and so there was some butting heads there, and one of Governor Milliken's former advisors had mentioned that, you know, since then there has been some streamlining to allow the executive branch to move a little bit more swiftly. And I think you are seeing that to some extent now that the state is responding a little bit more robustly to PFAS, where you're having the Department of Environment.
Eagle.
I always want to say a Department of Environmental Quality, but Environment, Great Lakes and Energy is moving alongside Governor Whitmer.
Well, let's not, you know, you've done this for us. Let's fast forward to today, to the PFAS crisis that we're facing. How are these two crises between PBB and PFAS, how are they different and how are they similar?
Yeah, so there was a lot of chaos immediately after this mix-up with the PBB crisis. You know, with PFAS, it's a little bit more slow moving. Right? In that we aren't seeing cattle being deformed. We're not, you know, there were mass protests where they were hanging Governor Milliken in effigy. That sort of reaction hasn't been in
livestock slaughters. And,
yeah.
You know, animals were slaughtered all over, weren't they?
That exactly.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. Like hundreds of heads of cattle across the state. But I mean, one similarity that we saw between the two of these is this really sort of long period of time between the discovery of the contamination and the sort of robust government response. With PFAS, you know, Robert Delaney, an employee at Eagle, now Eagle, you know, discovered this in 2010 and sort of blew the whistle from the inside and spoke to his bosses. And, you know, there weren't many changes that were made besides some sort of shorter term studies of fish and other wildlife. And eventually Delaney said, you know, I don't think this is enough. He went public with it. And shortly thereafter, that's when some massive changes started happening in 2017.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. You quote him as saying, you know, I look at the robust response today and I cannot believe the difference. Why the robust response? Does the state not want to look as bad as it looked with Flint water?
Well, yeah, and there's still maybe some, you have to do some speculation to figure out exactly why the robust response was there. I mean, the state will say, you know, that this was the moment late 2017 when we kind of realized that this might be a statewide issue and we need to launch a multi-agency response to this and really go out and aggressively search for PFAS everywhere. You know, the state basically says this was just time. The evidence was there. There's definitely some folks who think that a lot of it had to do with when Robert Delaney went public, when he went on a radio show and said, we're not taking this seriously enough. I mean, the statewide response was just weeks after that. But you did have some concerns about PFAS around the same time in West Michigan, in northern Kent County. And so that was kind of happening at the same time. There were some more tests going on around the time that the state launched the statewide response.
What about ownership, I'm using air quotes here, of both of these contamination issues? Certainly, it was a Velsicol chemical company in St. Louis with PBB in 1973. The two poster children, if you will, for PFAS would be the Air Force at the old Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Oscoda, and Wolverine Worldwide that made all the consumer products that had the PFAS in them in West Michigan. What kind of compare and contrast have we seen with taking ownership?
Yeah, and that one's there are some differences there. Like you said, there was kind of one company that manufactured the PBB in the 70s that then went statewide. And here with PFAS, we're still kind of trying to figure out the extent to which everyone who's involved in those companies and those chains that make and then distribute the products, who's involved there. I mean, PFAS is kind of everywhere in our environment now. You know, it's made by kind of big chemical companies who, you know, some are facing litigations in other states and including 3M and there's Attorney General Nessel here in Michigan has said that she's possibly planning a lawsuit against 3M. So there's companies like that, but then you know, then there's the Air Force who buys the chemicals and uses them and disposed of them at these Air Force bases and maybe didn't clean it up, and you know, the Air Force saying that it didn't know the dangers at that time. But so there's all these lines of potential responsible polluters there, from the manufacturer to those who used it and maybe didn't dispose of it properly.
In the meantime, if you're a citizen and you're looking at this soapy water at the lake at your, like Van Etten Lake, if you're in Oscoda, or if you're worrying about the water coming out of your tap, that you do talk to a lot of people that I think the frustration level is understandably pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a decent amount of time in West Michigan, where they're sort of grappling with this hometown hero. Wolverine really did bring a lot of jobs to the area.
The same way Velsicol did to St. Louis.
Yeah. Exactly. People don't want
to
kill.
And Wurtsmith actually to Oscoda, just to complete the story. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, people don't want to take down those sorts of giants that brought them jobs. But understandably, there's also a lot of frustration. And there was, I would say that most people in West Michigan seem to, you know, be pretty happy with the way that Wolverine was responding up until December of last year. That's when Wolverine said, you know, we need to get 3M involved in this before we're going to build a municipal water system, which is sort of one of the main demands of the townships over there, because these folks are living on whole house filters, which get the job done, but they don't tell you when they fail. It's sort of this place of uncertainty that people are living in. And so we're waiting to see essentially what's going to happen with 3M, and they're just in this period of uncertainty.
I recently spoke with New York Times author Seth Siegel. His book Troubled Water looks at the lead in water problems and PFAS water contamination all across the country. He made a couple key points. First, he noted that environmental protection agencies, state, federal, they're not the powerhouses that many people think they are. You know, environmental protection agency, there to protect us. Second, that whenever there has been action in water contamination, it happened because citizens basically rose up and they forced officials to act. And that certainly seems to fit with your reporting, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the groups in St. Louis and now in Oscoda and West Michigan and all over the state really are pretty fundamental to why change has happened in these situations. When we look at the folks in St. Louis, I mean, time and time again, they had local knowledge that pointed regulators to things that needed to be changed. And oftentimes, regulators had a little bit of trouble listening to them. It took time for these groups to fight for that change, and eventually they were right. I mean, over and over and over that came up.
Hello, Flint water.
Yep. Yeah. And when we're looking at PFAS, I mean, these folks are at the very beginning of this process. Unfortunately, these chemicals last a really, really long time. And as we see in St. Louis, the people who really make change happen are the ones who have kind of been with this for a long time and understand the long-term process. But these folks that are already starting activism around PFAS, have already done a lot. I mean, in West Michigan, there's a group that pointed regulators to the House Street site. You know, we've seen that over and over. Maybe you can talk about how Oscoda has done that.
Right. Well, in Oscoda, it was a little bit more influenced, I think, initially by Robert Delaney finding the widespread PFAS in 2010. And then, you know, since then, they're trying to, there's a citizen activist group there called Now, Need Our Water. And they're really trying to just kind of remind regulators that this was the first widespread PFAS site that was found. And it's been 7 years out, and the Air Force still hasn't offered a final plan to clean it up. And, you know, calling on the state to say, hey, figure out a way to hold the Air Force accountable there. But it's really interesting, too, you of course mentioned the Flint water crisis, and we don't do a lot of reporting back and looking back at Flint here. But there is one really interesting connection in that when we talk about how Robert Delaney went public with his concerns about PFAS, part of what he said motivated him to do that was because he did this at the same time that the state was prosecuting some of his colleagues at the DEQ for their role in the Flint water crisis and maybe, you know, not taking public concerns seriously. So it's everything is just so, all of these episodes of contamination just seem so interlinked. Like you even have that Flint element that's influencing part of this chain of events.
Your point about where Mr. Delaney was at the point where he said, I got to talk, because we were watching all of that, had the fallout from Flint happening.
Right. And he talks about being, of course, motivated to get this public health story out there, but he also, to some extent, was trying to save his own self because he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want it to come back to him that he knew that there was this PFAS threat here, and he didn't say anything publicly.
Well, some tremendous reporting and some very, very thought-provoking reading. And you can find all of these stories on PBB and PFAS at bridgemi.com. Riley Began, Jim Malowitz, congratulations on all that hard work and really terrific stories. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks
for having us.